Hello, you're listening to the Millport Podcast. So, what have we got for you this week? Well, I've been chatting to local Paul Watling about the centenary of the Crocodile Rock. Also, if you ever wanted to know what it's like working on the Clyde, we've been chatting to Robert McGarity, a purser on the Cumbria Ferry, on what life is like on the Ocean Wave. Also this week, we were lucky enough to have a tour and a chat with Senior Lecturer at the Marine Biology Station, Philip Smith. You probably know that the Marine Biology Station is the big red stone building as you come into the town, right next to a pier. We had a tour and a chat about the facility and its future. But all that and more in this, episode 2 of the Millport Podcast, which starts now. Right, this week the news comes from a very secluded beach on the island. In fact, not many folk know about it, but they will do after this, because I'm going to spill the beans. There's a hidden beach, and if you come down to cycle around the island, chances are you don't know where it is, but I'm about to tell you. If you're in the town, head out towards the boatyard. You probably know it. It's way at the far end of the town. Anyway, you'll see a swing gate for walkers to go through. Go through that, follow the path all the way around, over to the pump station. You see another gate, go through that. We'll follow and trace the coast round for not too far at all, and there you'll find it. A white sandy beach that no one else knows about. Well, until now, you now know where it is. Well, that's what I'm doing the news from today, and I'm sitting here with my toes in the sand and surrounded by a couple of oyster catchers. If you don't know what they are, I'll describe them to you. They're blackbirds with orange beaks, and they're sitting looking at me as if I've got something for you, but I haven't. I haven't got anything with me, nothing on me at all. Go away. So, the news. Locals have created a petition to reinstate the Millport school bus to ferry local kids from the island over to the high school in Largs. Currently, a local bus takes the kids from the town to the ferry slip, where they have to walk on and walk off at the other side, whereas they used to have a bus on the other side too, which was sadly axed due to budget cuts. The petition can be found at change.org if you want to sign it. In other news, the marquee, which usually resides within the garrison grounds for special occasions, you probably know it better as the big white tent, was vandalised recently by what has been called a bladed weapon. Local police have appealed for witnesses or anyone with any information on this attack to come forward. Millport, as you'll know, doesn't have a burgeoning crime rate, but this act of vandalism has prompted calls for the erection of a CCTV camera within the garrison grounds. Also this week, the dates for the highly popular Sail and Oar Festival were announced. The festival, which draws racing teams from all over the UK and beyond, will take place on the weekend of Friday the 9th of August. The weekend also includes a popular raft race on the Sunday, in which local teams tie together wheelie bins, barrels and load them with water balloons and race from Kames Bay to the pier. It's always a good laugh, and if you can make it along, the more the better. Now, chances are, if you've ever visited Millport, you've stood next to or climbed on top of it and had your picture taken with it. I am, of course, talking about the painted reptile, the Crocodile Rock. But did you know how it came into being? Not in a geological sense, and those of you looking for geological explanations are probably best to look elsewhere. But if you want to know who was the first person to paint it, why they painted it, and who paints it still, listen on. The town celebrated the centenary of the croc being in existence and held a wee get-together organised by Paul Watling. I caught up with the man within the marquee to find out more. They were just packing up and the wind had increased, making the plastic walls rattle and shake. Here's what he had to say. So, pop the tape in and press play. What's your name, sir, and what do you do?
My name's Paul Watling. I look after the Millport Holiday Apartments, and I also am going to be looking after the Visitors Centre, and that'll be opening next week. And I also make models and calendars and write poems and create crossword puzzles and anything else I can do to earn a few pence.
Can you tell us how the croc came into being?
Local folklore tells us that a chap called Robert Brown, who was a businessman from Glasgow, retired here, and he had a group of friends who used to meet over lunchtime in the tavern and called themselves the Toddy Brigade. Now, one day after their afternoon tipple, Mr. Brown came out of the tavern and said to the landlord, "How many have I had today, Jimmy?" And the landlord replied, "Just the usual, Brune." And he said, "I may be so, but that rock over there looks awfully like a crocodile." And he went home and came back with three pots of paint and painted it.
Who maintains it? I've always wanted to know.
I've asked around, but no one seems to know.
For the last, it's been looked after now by the Burns Club, the local Burns Club, and they've appointed a local painter, Brian Elliott. And every year or two, or when need be, he comes in and repaints or touches up as required. But it's the Burns Club who are responsible. Brian Elliott is the painter.
Do you know anywhere else in Scotland or the world that paints geological formations?
I don't know anywhere at all. And the interesting thing is that back in the day when Kodak used to develop your pictures for you, the Crocodile Rock was in the top 10 of the most photographed items in the whole of Scotland, according to Kodak's records. I don't know what the other nine were, but I don't think there was another painted rock amongst them.
You're going through a bit of an endeavour just now, trying to source photographs. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, we're looking to get as many photographs together as we can of people on the crocodile. I've got a Flickr page set up for people to upload the photographs to, and there are now 32 photographs have been submitted. Two of them are photographs of the crocodile with nobody on it. One of them is the crocodile Chippy, but the rest are photographs of people on the crocodile. And this weekend has been the launch of a push for more photographs for that. And the idea is once we've got enough in, we'll be doing we'll be doing a display in the garrison that as more photos come in, the pictures will be changed so that it's a different display each month throughout the summer season.
So how can folk help out if they have pictures of the rock?
I'd love any photographs as old as possible. As long as if they want to send them in, they'll be posted back, or they can scan them and upload them themselves, whichever way they'd rather do it. And if we can accumulate as many as possible. The other thing I'd like to do is if people have got old photographs of themselves or their family and friends on the crocodile, if they can come back this year and recreate the old photograph so we can have a then and now collection.
Paul Watling there, and if you have any pictures of yourself and the croc, get in contact with Paul via his Twitter handle at Visit Cumbrae or through the Flickr page he set up. Now, unless you're a channel swimmer or own a boat or are a fisherman from the Sea of Galilee, the only way you're going to get across the Clyde is by ferry. Calmac is the largest operator in Scotland and services the Cumbrae to Largs route. Want to know more about the people who create the service? I bought a ticket and went for a sail one afternoon and chatted to crew member Robert McGarity about life on the waves. We chatted up on the top deck of the ferry inside the wee seating area. You probably hear the ferry clacks and passengers coming and going as we approach Largs. Press and play now. So, introduce yourself. What's your name, sir?
Yeah, it's Robert McGarity. I'm a seaman purser. What I do basically, my main job, as you know, keeping an accurate number of the passengers coming on, make sure the cars and vehicles are parked safely, make sure everybody's all right, everybody's happy.
So you're local yourself, or?
Yes, stay in Inverkip. So it's a nice wee drive in the morning and at night, you know. Quite enjoy it.
It's not too bad at all.
Aye.
Is it your seasonal? Is this the one route you work on, or do you work in any?
Aye, mainly it's mainly Largs Cumbrae, but I do occasionally get sent away. I've been away to Gia. I've been as far away as Barra. I quite enjoyed that, you know, a week away in Barra.
It's not too bad.
It's quite pleasant. So I got to on a Sunday. It's a wee bit more relaxed. So got to see a bit of the island, you know.
How long have you been with Calmac?
Basically, I was kind of in between jobs at the time, and I'd always liked the thought of working on the boats, working with Calmac, and I'd tried for several years. And 4 years ago, I kept kind of plugging it, and I was lucky enough to get an interview and got a seasonal job, you know. But I don't know, the way things are going just now, with the tenders up, next year, it's kind of worrying, you know, not knowing what the future holds, but, you know, I'm alright up until the middle of October.
Cumbrae is a popular destination for holidaymakers, and the ferry queues are legendary. Any advice from passengers? Where to go, where to stand?
Well, it's probably better that they don't really stand too near the car deck, you know what I mean? Get up the stairs. I always try and encourage the passengers to go up to the, you know, the kind of higher decks, observation decks as they call them, you can see some nice sights, you know. Aye, out there, the higher the better.
We've had some pretty fierce storms down the years, sometimes with waves the size of bungalows. What's the worst weather you've ever been out in?
Not too bad. I don't think they go out in as bad weather as they used to, but it's down to the skipper, really, at the end of the day. But I've been out in, not especially rough, we're kind of enclosed here. We've got a wee bit of shelter, you know, but yeah, I've been out in some fairly rough where the waves are, you know, crashing over onto the deck. But, you know, I wouldn't go out unless, you know, we felt it was safe. I mean, that's another part of the job I quite enjoy is, you know, doing the drills, which we tend to do on a Sunday. Occasionally I do them on other days, but mostly on a Sunday.
Missing the ferry is an islander's worst nightmare. So, refresh your knowledge. When's the first and last run?
Right, during the week, 6:45 in the morning. That's your first run from Lars over to Cumbrae. So you're arriving there at just before 7. On the Sunday, it's 9:15. We start a wee bit later on a Sunday, a couple of hours. On a Friday night, we do one late run. Normally, we finish at 8:30, it's the last run from the island. 8:30 at night, over to Lars. On a Friday night, we do a late run at 10:15, and it's 10:30 off the island. So
most days, 8:15 is the last one from Largs, then?
Aye, quarter past eight from Largs.
What happens when folk miss it? Miss kind of,
well,
get kind of interesting.
No, basically that's their own fault, if you like, you know what I mean? It's not, unless it's an emergency, unless it's a blue light emergency, that's the only occasion that we would do a, you know, an extra run or a run that's not, you know, on the timetable. If somebody's missed a ferry, it's unfortunate for them, you know.
It's the one fear islanders have, you know, that you'll miss it somehow.
Yeah. If we do, you get the occasional phone call, very, very seldom, you know, where there's a, you know, phone ahead, we're running late, any chance of holding on? And I have known it happen, you know, well, 5-10 minutes maybe, you know, at the max, but, you know, it does happen.
So your advice is,
and they try, I think they try their best, you know, to accommodate this thing happening, you know.
Absolutely. So your advice is, be here on time.
Yeah, well, I mean, it says in the brochure 10 minutes before, you know, we're due to sail. Yeah. You should be here, and they've bought your ticket, you know, so.
Robert McGarity there, and thanks to CalMac for allowing us on board. For more information on CalMac services, check out calmac.co.uk. So, if you've ever been to Cumbrae and passed the big red stone building at the entrance to the town, you've probably thought to yourself, I wonder what goes on in there. Well, that's the Marine Biology Station run by the University of London. The station has been in the news lately, as the University of London was reported to be pulling the funding for the station, and as such, it would be closing. This, of course, would have an enormous impact upon the already fragile local economy. But I'm happy to report that plans are afoot to maintain the station. Wanting to know more, I headed along to chat to senior lecturer Philip Smith. We started off with a tour of the aquarium. Surrounded by walls of glass, full of things with fins and claws, we looked on at the curious beasties who looked straight back at us.
In terms of species and tanks here, you've got, there's a lobster in there? Or?
Yes, there's the common lobster or the European lobster. So blue in real life. A lot of people think lobsters are red because that's the colour they go when they're cooked. But that's the real McCoy there. So the antennae are red, and he's sitting in a pipe there that's been provided as a home for him. And the other related species we've got in a tank just next to us here are squat lobsters. Again, they're crustaceans. They're in a group of crustaceans called decapods because they have 10 legs, including the claws. And these particular ones are actually more closely related to hermit crabs, which is a different group, biologically speaking, of crustaceans than the common lobster. But very, very numerous species in the Clyde.
They look as though they're quite up for a fight, almost like they're in a sort of a boxing position with a...
Yes, they have these long claws. Their common name is the long-clawed squat lobster. and they use them in defence against predators and probably also in fights, particularly between males. We had a research project a couple of years ago looking at this particularly because some of the larger males, their claws change shape as they grow, and they become not only longer and larger, but they develop a much more pincer-like form with sharp points on the claw that appear to be adapted for inflicting puncture wounds on their opponents. And if you look at closely at the claws of other males, you often find little kind of scars that are the remains of puncture wounds where these individuals have been fighting each other, and fighting probably for access to females.
We then walked through the aquarium and into the visitor museum, where a mock-up of the Ark, the original station, is displayed. Here Philip explained the history of the station.
Yes, this is a mock-up of what was known as a research cabin on the Ark, and there's a photograph of the Ark on the wall there. And so the Ark was essentially a floating laboratory that formed the first marine station in Millport. The history of the station goes back to the first global oceanographic voyage by a ship called HMS Challenger, which took place in the 1870s. And that was when that returned to Britain. At the time, Edinburgh was a major centre of oceanography, and there was an oceanographer called Sir John Murray who was tasked with working up the samples that had been taken from the deep oceans all around the world. And he was looking to compare these deep ocean samples with samples from shallow seas. And initially he was sampling in the Firth of Forth in the east of Scotland, but he wasn't getting the variety of species that he needed there, and it was exposed to bad weather as well. So increasingly he was coming through to the Clyde to sample here. He had developed this barge into a floating lab and initially kept it in a flooded quarry in Granton near Edinburgh. But as he over time shifted his base of operations through to Millport here into the Clyde, he brought the Ark through the Forth and Clyde Canal. David Robertson, the Cumbrian naturalist as he was known, persuaded him to set it up here, and it was pulled up on the shore at Port Loy, which is just a short distance away from the marine station, in 1885, and so that was the first marine station in Millport. That survived until the turn of the century. And by that time, David Robertson and his business colleagues had clubbed together to build a more permanent marine station. And the building that we're standing in now, or the part of the building that we're in now, was the original building that formed the marine station in Millport. And so that was opened in 1897.
After leaving the aquarium, we headed to Philip's office. And if you can hear them in the background, the oyster catchers are still having the domestic. Anyway, back to where it was. After leaving the aquarium, we headed to Philip's office along winding linoleum corridors that reminded me of the swimming baths for some reason. Here I asked the man to properly introduce himself and tell us a little bit more about what he does.
I'm Philip Smith. I'm a senior lecturer at the marine station in Millport. I've been here 11 years now. One of my main roles at the station is in coordinating an MSc course that we have here with 12 students this year who are here for 6 months of the year from April through until September. We run this course jointly with one of the colleges in the University of London, and the students spend the first half of their course in London and the second half with us. Optionally, they can also undertake a coral reef ecology course in the Red Sea, which most of them did this year just prior to coming to Millport.
Can't imagine why.
So as if moving from London to Millport wasn't enough of a culture shock, they've done it via the tropics. So that's one of my main teaching roles. In my capacity as a lecturer, I also lecture to courses for Glasgow University and London University and some other groups. My research area is mainly on the ecology and behaviour of crustaceans, so things like crabs and lobsters and shrimps. Some of that is just out of fundamental interest about how these things behave and why their behaviour has evolved to be the way that it is. Very often it has an applied aspect as well in relation to fisheries or sometimes aquaculture, but mainly in terms of understanding how fishing gear operates, for example, and why it catches some animals and other animals are not caught by the gear, either because they've managed to escape from it or pass through the meshes of the gear or simply not responded in a way that's allowed them to be captured. That sort of information is important for fishery managers to understand the way that the fishery operates and how any changes that they might impose to try to improve the sustainability of the fishery, you know, how they may work out in the long run. Another strand of that kind of research is understanding the biology of the species that are being fished as well. You know, so how quickly do they grow? How long do they live? How do they interact with each other? And how does that affect their biological processes of growth and reproduction?
And yes, you can hear it. The oyster catchers are still having their domestic. Anyway, the station has an accommodation block for visiting students. I was curious, where do they all come from?
A large number come from the University of London, but and that's because the University of London is the parent organisation of the Marine Station in Millport, so it owns the station and it employs the staff. And the figures are something like 40% or so of the students that come here are from one of the constituent colleges of the University of London. But the rest come from a variety of other universities. The University of Glasgow is one of the nearest large universities, and lots of students come from there. But there are about 30 other universities that bring groups here too, some of whom we teach directly ourselves and some who come with their own staff to make use of the facilities that are here. And so, for example, as we're speaking at the moment, there's a group from Swansea University who arrived this weekend, and they'll be here for the rest of the week.
The station, as I said before, is currently in an uncertain position regarding its future. What is the current situation?
Yes, sure. The background to the circumstances the station are in at the moment is that some of the core funding from the station came from the body that funds universities in England primarily. We get some money also from the Scottish University funding body. The English body decided to withdraw the main element of our core funding. The University of London decided after that that it couldn't afford to continue to run the Marine Station, and decided that it needed to transfer it to another parent organisation, or in the worst case, to close it altogether. Since that situation became known towards the end of last year, 2012, there have been lots of negotiations between the university and the Scottish Government, the University of London and other universities, and other types of organisation that may be able to play a role in the future of the Marine Station. The news that has come out just last week is that there have been successful discussions with an organisation called the Field Studies Council, which is an educational charity that operates quite a large number of field centres throughout England and Wales, and they have one in Scotland at Kindrogan, which is near Aviemore. So they're the mainly field centres that provide facilities for terrestrial fieldwork. But they also have a couple of centres in Pembrokeshire where universities go and other school groups go as well to do marine work on the shores that are there. And so there's been a preliminary agreement between the university and the Field Studies Council that the marine station will be transferred from the university to the Field Studies Council at the end of 2013. With the FSE running the site from January 2014. So if that goes ahead as planned, that's really good news. It will save the site here, the Marine Station site, as a continuing centre of marine science. But there are still details to be worked out as to exactly how the site will be staffed, for example, and the types of activity that will go on here.
The museum and the aquarium are open for visitors. Can you tell us a little bit more about it?
The museum and aquarium, they're called the Robertson Museum and Aquarium in honour of David Robertson, Dr. David Robertson, to give him his proper title, who was the the Cumbrian naturalist, a Victorian naturalist who was instrumental in the marine station being established here. And from the very beginning of the marine station, there was this... it was seen to be important to allow the public to have access to learning about the marine environment and marine species. And so there has always been an aquarium of some sort in the station for the public to visit. And so it's currently the museum and aquarium are open during normal working hours. So when the station is open, then the public can come in. And so we get a steady stream of visitors from locals and also people who are visiting the island and making their way around the island on foot or on cycle and calling in at the marine station to have a look at the beasties that we've got in the tanks there.
Well, thanks again to Philip and the station for having us round. For more information on the marine station, now you need a pen and paper for this one because it's quite a long web address, head along to GLA, that's GLA, .ac.uk/centres /marine station, or just simply Google marine station Millport. Oh, excuse me, hay fever. Anyway, that's all for this week. For more information, head along to s1millport.com. Until next time, bye bye.